ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you think you'd never be targeted with disinformation? Well, remember hearing about those new Australian road rules? Curfews for drivers over 60 and mandates to keep your lights on. That was actually an AI disinformation campaign. G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. I'm a journalist, and I've been learning that online tactics just like this are being used regularly to seed mistrust in government decision-making. You can join me as I interrogate the world of mis and disinformation. Stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
Do you find forgiveness easy when you've been wronged or harmed by someone? Do you think it's important to try and let go, move on, for the sake of your own well-being? Are there limits? For example, should you be asked to forgive a perpetrator of war crimes, of murder, of domestic violence? Today on Big Ideas, forgiveness. Do we really need it? Hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell. Welcome. Taking you to the University of Sydney on Gadigal Country today for the annual Anderson Lectures in Philosophy. Philosopher Professor Lucy Allais is exploring the ethics and emotions surrounding forgiveness. She is from the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa and also Johns Hopkins University. And she's in conversation with University of Sydney Professor of Philosophy Luke Russell. They're exploring whether forgiveness can be viewed as a moral gift, something freely offered, even when it isn't deserved, perhaps. Or has it been turned into a moral obligation, a demand that we place on victims for the sake of social harmony? Let's take it away.
So I'll start by saying forgiveness is a possible response to wrongdoing, but there are all sorts of different possible responses to wrongdoing. After wrongdoing, we might encounter apology, refusal to apologise, punishment, remorse, anger, blame, reconciliation, estrangement, and so on. A really diverse range of reactions, and forgiveness is one of them. So, Lucy, what is forgiveness, and how does it relate to all of those other possible responses to wrongdoing?
It's really interesting. When you tell non-philosophers that you're working on forgiveness, they usually start asking you about really interesting questions like practical questions, how do you go about forgiving someone, or, you know, complicated questions like what is it to forgive the dead? But philosophers are always interested in like really basic questions. So I always tell my students that the really good philosophical question is, what does that even mean? So philosophers are, what does it even mean to forgive someone? And fascinatingly, philosophers really disagree on this quite a lot. So forgiveness clearly is different to a blaming response to wrongdoing. It's got something to do with a release from blame. Some philosophers think that release from blame is enacted by the ritual of speaking the words, I forgive you, in response to an apology. And some think it's a matter of no longer requiring the wrongdoer to make amends. But I think that forgiveness is centrally what I call a change of heart. So a change in the way you feel towards the wrongdoer. But that's quite a complicated answer because there's a lot to be said about what that change of feeling is. And even, of course, since we're philosophers, what is a feeling even?
So one of the ways in which we try and latch on to forgiveness is to look at the common metaphors or figures of speech that are used to express this idea. And some of these have a biblical origin, some of them are more recent. We might hear forgiveness being described as a way of letting it go or a way of moving on. My favourite metaphor for forgiveness is when you've forgiven someone, you no longer hold it against them. These are all kind of helpful ways of getting an idea of what we're talking about. But Lucy, you've got a very particular view about the way in which the person who has forgiven no longer holds that wrong against the wrongdoer. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, thanks, Luke. So that's exactly right. And I'm glad to hear that's your favourite metaphor because that's mine as well. I think it exactly captures what's at the heart of forgiveness. So, but to make sense of that, I think we need to understand a little bit about what what emotions are and what the feelings that are involved in forgiveness are. Because people sometimes talk as if emotions are somehow opposed to reason, or as if it's just like a mere feeling, like not something that's so important. But in fact, feelings are, you know, central to what makes life worth living. There isn't any caring without feeling and emotion. And philosophers and psychologists writing about emotion are very interested in the idea that emotions have content. So if I'm angry with you, my anger isn't just like an itch. It's about you and something that you've done. So my anger has you as its object, and there's a way that it presents you as being. And since emotions have objects and content like that, they can be appropriate or inappropriate. So we don't talk about emotions as being true or false in the way that we do beliefs. But we do talk about emotions as being appropriate or inappropriate, proportionate or disproportionate. You know, you might say to somebody like, don't be so angry about that. It was only something really small. And you're saying that the anger is disproportionate. Or you might say, like, I really understand why you're angry with me. I know that this is the third time that I've done this and you really want to be. So you're acknowledging that the anger is proportionate. So I think that's one really important thing for making sense of forgiveness. Then the next thing that I think is important about the emotions that are at issue with forgiveness is that there's a particular kind of emotional response to other people that I think plays a really central role in our lives, which is our emotional responses or sort of feeling involving attitudes to what people's actions say about them. So if you think about gratitude is a feeling involving way of seeing a person as having done something for you that went beyond what you were entitled to expect them to do. So that's actually really complicated. So not only do these feelings have content, but that's complicated content. It's got this kind of me seeing you, seeing me, seeing you kind of structure to it. And I think that the angry emotions, the blaming emotions that are at issue when somebody wrongs you, also have that kind of structure. They see the person, they, in a feeling involving way, evaluate the person in a way that reflects the thing that they've done. And I think when you forgive them, you stop having that feeling involving evaluation of them. So you stop feeling towards them in a way that's informed by their wrongdoing. And another way of putting that, and this I think actually gets to the heart of what makes forgiveness quite mysterious to lots of philosophers, is that you're in a feeling involving way, seeing them as better than their action indicates them to be.
Okay, Lucy, I want you to tell us about the difference between forgiving on the one hand and some other ways of moving past your resentment or your blame. So these other ways in particular that I want you to talk about are excusing the wrongdoer, saying it wasn't really your fault, and justifying the action, something like, oh, I see you actually had a good reason to do that. So they're both things that would take away my resentment. Are they ways of forgiving?
So this is a great question. Ordinarily, we might sort of run these things together a bit because excusing and justifying are ways of ceasing to blame. So if forgiving involves a release from these kind of angry, blaming feelings that are responses to wrongdoing, and one way of coming to not have those feelings is, you know, changing your view of what the person did by seeing it as excused or justified. But lots of philosophers, including myself, think that that's not forgiving, because in fact, excusing and justifying are ways of coming to see that there isn't anything to forgive. So suppose I'm late to meet you, and you're really annoyed, and then I explain to you that there was, you know, such terrible weather that the whole transport system broke down. You'll see that it wasn't my fault. So hopefully, it doesn't always work like that, but often, hopefully, you'll stop being angry because you'll come to see that there isn't anything that I did wrong. Or if I'm late to meet you and I rush in and tell you, like, I'm so sorry I'm late, I had to get someone to hospital in an emergency, it was a matter of life or death, you'll come to see that what I did was justified. I did keep you waiting, but, you know, matter of life or death is more important. So you'll, again, you know, our emotions sometimes have residues, so it doesn't always immediately happen like this, but hopefully you'll see that what I did was justified and you'll stop being angry. But in both of those cases, you come to see that there isn't anything to forgive. So what philosophers think is puzzling about forgiveness is that it's a way of overcoming or releasing or somehow getting past the blame feeling while continuing to see that the thing that warrants the blame feeling still stands and is warranted. And that's what that seems puzzling.
So when you forgive, you still judge that that person wronged you and it was that person's fault.
Exactly. Otherwise, there's nothing to forgive.
Okay. So if forgiving involves getting rid of anger, resentment, blame, we might ask whether anger and resentment, those negative emotions, have any proper role to play. Are they just bad things that we'd be better off without? Or do you think, no, blaming and resenting are useful, important things that sometimes are appropriate?
Yeah, that's also a great question. So people do sometimes talk as if anger and resentment and blame are simply something we'd be better off without. And certainly many people would be better off with less anger and blame. And people also sometimes talk about, you know, you shouldn't judge. But I actually think, along with many other philosophers, that anger and blame and even judging have a role to play in our lives. So going all the way back to Aristotle said that it's foolish to not be angry at things that for which anger is appropriate. And he says that a virtuous person is angry at the right things in the right way at the right time. And more recently, lots of philosophers have been defending a constructive role for anger and blame. So Miranda Fricker, who's a British philosopher now based in the US, she's got a really lovely account, I think, of what she calls communicative blame, where she takes account, of course, there are lots of ways in which blame can go wrong, and we should pay attention to those. But she says it's something that plays an important role in our lives if we see the point as being communicating to someone with emotional force about a way in which they have failed to meet some legitimate expectation and trying to get them to see that. And the idea that you want to get someone you care about to understand why something that they did hurt you and to care about the fact that it hurt you, to me, there's nothing negative about that as a response to things. So the idea that you should never have that response, to me, is a way of either not seeing people as responsible agents who are, you know, make choices and are responsible for their actions, or not caring. So you could get to that point through complete detachment, but I think I don't see that that's desirable. I think, you know, in interpersonal relationships where we care about each other, it's not unreasonable to care about somebody hurting you and to want them to understand why they've hurt you and to see what's at issue. So similarly with judging, you know, of course we can be too judgmental, but we have no other way of understanding other people than what their actions, including their words, tell us about them. So it's reasonable to take people's actions as reflecting who they are. We have nothing else to go on. So I think that taking people's actions as telling us something about them is part of what it is to take the person seriously as a person, as an agent. And these emotion-involving responses, like gratitude, blame, trust, are ways of doing that. So I would defend blame and anger as having potentially having a constructive role. That doesn't mean they can't get out of control, and we should also pay attention to that.
Okay, so if anger and blame are sometimes useful, and if forgiving involves moving beyond your anger and blame, maybe moderating or even eliminating your anger and blame, while still judging that that person wronged you and had no good excuse, we've got a bit of a philosophical puzzle here, right? It starts to look like maybe forgiveness is irrational or never justified. When you forgive, it's not like you're excusing and saying, oh, it wasn't really your fault, so my anger and blame is inappropriate. When you forgive, you're still judging. It was your fault. My anger and blame is still in some sense appropriate, but I'm deciding perhaps, or I'm finding that I'm letting that go. So this is a bit of a challenge. Do you think, if that's your view of forgiveness, that forgiveness is somehow irrational, or that when you're forgiving, you're doing something that you yourself think is unjustified?
So this is a great question, and it's a central issue that philosophers writing about forgiveness have engaged with. And a central strategy that philosophers have for engaging with this puzzle is to say, well, what makes forgiveness make sense is the wrongdoer apologizing and making amends. Because we've seen this structure where the wrongdoer's action is the thing that warrants the anger and blame. And we've said that, you know, these emotional responses can be warranted. So if we don't want it to be irrational, it looks like one way of making it not irrational is for the wrongdoer to do things to change the judgments that warrant their action. Now, I think that that is a perfectly reasonable sequence of events. You know, that's a good series of things to happen. But I think that it undersells forgiveness, because I think it makes forgiveness just a matter of, like, accurately tracking your attitudes to exactly what the person deserves. And I think that forgiveness is something more powerful and slightly more mysterious than that, which gives the wrongdoer something that goes beyond what they are able to show that they deserve. So I think of forgiveness as that there's something essentially generous, something gifted about it, that at the core of forgiveness is something that goes beyond what the wrongdoer is able to demonstrate that they've earned. And I think if we don't include that, so with the puzzle Luke was raising is that it was beginning to look like forgiveness was irrational. But if we go all the way to the other side of saying all these things that the wrongdoer does to demonstrate that they've earned it, forgiveness starts looking a bit trivial, like you just ought to see people in the ways that they ought to be seen. And but we talk about forgiveness as if it's this powerful, transformative thing, and if it's praiseworthy. But it doesn't seem so praiseworthy to just sort of accurately track the way you ought to see people. So the puzzle is, how do we avoid forgiveness being, on the one hand, irrational, and on the other hand, sort of a bit trivial and not particularly praiseworthy? Yeah, so I think at the center of it is somehow going beyond what the wrongdoer is able to demonstrate that they deserve.
Okay, so we're now in the territory of asking what's good about forgiveness, or what can we achieve by forgiving? Why would we choose or strive to get over our resentment in a case where we think the person who wronged us had no good excuse? And philosophers and psychologists have offered a range of different answers to that question. What's good about forgiveness? One kind of answer is what I'm going to call a therapeutic view of forgiveness. This is very common in psychology. This is the kind of thing that Oprah Winfrey will tell you about forgiveness. According to this story, what's good about forgiveness is that it releases the resentful victim from the burden of resenting. It's a way of allowing the victim to move on from his or her anger and regain happiness. Right? I'm sure this is a familiar story to many of you. And according to this therapeutic approach, that's what matters about forgiveness, and that's why victims should forgive. They should forgive to regain their own happiness. This is a view, while it's incredibly common in psychology, a view that's pretty contentious in philosophy. Lucy, what are your thoughts about that therapeutic approach to forgiveness?
It's a super interesting question, Luke. And if you Google forgiveness on the internet, you'll come up with a million inspirational memes which have exactly that theme. I don't think that there's nothing to that idea. I think forgiveness can feel like a really important release to people, and that can be a powerful and good thing. I think there are two questions I would have about that view. The one is that I think that forgiveness is essentially relational. It's about the person who's wronged you and not just about your own kind of mental hygiene. So, you know, I think it's important that the view of the other person is involved. The other thing I think is that, I do want to argue for a view of forgiveness that I think is really quite powerful and transformative and even a bit mysterious, that plays a really important role in our lives. But I also want to argue for a view on which forgiveness is extremely discretionary. It's something that is up to the victim whether or not they want to do it. And I think that you don't have to forgive. So in many cases, I think you can't get through life never forgiving anyone. Actually, I think you can't have a relationship with human beings without ever forgiving anyone. But I don't think that on some particular instance, in particular acts of wrongdoing have to be forgiven. And I think that there are other ways of achieving the maybe Oprah Winfrey sort of mental hygiene, which include putting the person out of your mind. You know, so there are ways of overcoming resentment that are different to forgiving. Do a course of meditation in which you put the person out of your mind. Maybe that's not achievable for everybody, and maybe for some people, forgiving is the way they overcome the resentment, which is fine. I don't have a criticism of that. I do think it is reasonable, and forgiveness can be really meaningful in that way. But I don't think it's the only way to achieve peace of mind. You can cease being angry and overcome by resentment by regarding somebody as beneath contempt. And I don't think somebody who's regarded in that way would feel forgiven.
Another really interesting challenge to the therapeutic view is the thought that while resentment is burdensome to many people, some people seem to thrive on resentment and be energized by their resentment and find a lot of meaning in their life through their targeted anger. And I think this is a good challenge to the kind of Oprah Winfrey recommendation to forgive. If the aim is your personal happiness, the victim's personal happiness, because sometimes I think some people are made quite happy by having their hated target who they can hate on for the rest of their lives.
Probably advise such people to that's not probably not the healthiest way of living.
Philosophers Lucy L.A. and Luke Russell are exploring what changes inside us and between us when we choose to forgive someone. The Anderson Lectures at the University of Sydney. And by the way, the late John Anderson was a very influential, sometimes controversial, Scottish philosopher at the university. When James Joyce's Ulysses was banned in Australia back in 1930, Anderson became the founding president of the Free Thought Society. And I'm Natasha Mitchell with ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas. Now, can refusing to forgive be the most honest, not hard-hearted, response in some circumstances?
Okay, I want to talk about a different possible justification for forgiveness, a different possible good that might come from forgiving. And this one is not just focused exclusively on the victim who chooses to forgive, but is relational. So a lot of philosophers have said that one of the key features of forgiveness is that forgiveness heals relationships that have been damaged or ruptured by wrongdoing. And the idea here is forgiveness is in some ways similar to reconciliation, close to that. Forgiveness perhaps is a source of not just inner peace, but interpersonal peace as well. Now, if this is true, if forgiveness is a way of healing the rift created by wrongdoing, then some justifications of forgiveness might point to the social benefits that come from healed relationships. Maybe forgiveness is something that we ought to do, at least some of the time, because it allows us to start again, start afresh, continue with valuable relationships, or heal situations that have been really damaged by sustained conflict. What are your thoughts about that justification for forgiving?
Yeah, I think that's really important. So I do think that forgiveness has its most central role in interpersonal relationships, in enabling us to move forward together in a way that doesn't see each other as defined forever by our worst actions. And I think that is a really important thing in relationships. I don't think that forgiving is the only way of getting past conflict. So you can reconcile without forgiving. And I still think it's important that we have other tools. So, for example, you know, maybe this only applies to minor things, but, you know, with some of the conflicts you have with your partner, possibly accepting at some point is better than continuing to demand change and accountability and therefore bringing forgiveness into the picture. So I think accepting is a different response, one which ceases to demand that the person change or meet some kind of different standard. And that also plays a role in our lives. And so sometimes, you know, you just sort of accept that this is who the person is and you're not going to require them to be anything different. So I think that forgiving isn't the only way we can move forward together after wrongdoing. And that's, I think that's actually quite important in a political context. But I think it does play a really important role in moving together past wrongdoing. But understanding that, we might get back to saying a little bit more about what forgiveness is that enables it to play that role.
So, Lucy, tell us, you've just said you can reconcile with someone who wronged you while not forgiving them. Now, some people might be puzzled by that. What's the difference? And if you reconciled with someone, how could it be that you haven't forgiven them?
So I think that when you reconcile with someone, you stop fighting with them. And I think you can stop fighting with someone while still having your view of them informed by the thing that they've done. And it could even be, so that you can definitely think of ways in which that could happen in a political case. But in an interpersonal case, you could even think of, you know, just sort of maybe some small wrong. It's not, the way in which you're holding it against the person isn't disproportionate. It's not extreme. I'm not raging at you anymore. I'm not shouting about it. I'm not going to keep going on about it, but it's on the record. You know, in my little black book where I keep a list of the things you've done, it's in my mind, there's a little check there against that. And it's not disproportionate. I'm not like freaking out and thinking that this is now all of you. It's just that it's, you know, it's there in the record. And I think you wouldn't feel forgiven in that case, but we could move forward with that being the case. I'm not fighting you. So I think reconciling is fundamentally a matter of hostility is ceasing, but I think that hostilities can cease without the emotional change that is forgiveness having fully taken place.
So I want to ask you about healing in the context of forgiveness. And in some of your work on forgiveness, you have written about people who came before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa who were wanting to forgive people who had perpetrated atrocities against family members. These are really difficult, really interesting, revealing cases. Can you tell us about those cases? And what do you think about those examples of forgiveness? What do you think they teach philosophers who are, you know, often writing in a very abstract, complicated context, maybe feeling a bit separate from the real world? What do we learn from looking at those kind of cases?
So I've written a bit, as Luke mentions, about the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's important that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was not officially about forgiveness. It was officially about uncovering what had happened, because a lot of the atrocities had been officially denied during the apartheid period, about giving victims a chance to tell their stories, and there was supposed to also be a reparations process, little bit of questions about how much that really happened. And then also there was an amnesty process for perpetrators of atrocity. So it was a very interesting and I think both morally and politically creative response to many of the difficulties of transitional justice. In particular, the amnesty held personalized amnesties. So previous political amnesty processes had involved blanket amnesties behind closed doors, like in the Chilean process. So in South Africa, it was individual amnesties, and you had to come and say what you'd done. So not full accountability, but not nothing. So and more than previous processes had achieved. Forgiveness wasn't any part of the official structure of it, but the leadership of the process, who brought a lot of particular kind of religious view to the process, did talk a lot about forgiveness. So Archbishop Desmond Tutu, in his book about the TRC, the book is called No Future Without Forgiveness. And so forgiveness was an important part for him of how it was framed. And that was interesting because there was quite a bit of criticism of that, because there was criticism that victims were put under unfair pressure to forgive. So the perpetrators were getting amnesty. Victims would, who were not really getting anything, would be tell their stories and then be asked, and do you forgive? Which is problematic, to put people under that kind of pressure. So there's a lot of complexity with the TRC, but in the process, there were some really remarkable instances of real reconciliation between perpetrators and victims, and of victims really talking very strongly and powerfully about forgiveness. There was a woman who was wanting to find out who had tortured and killed her father, who said, "We want to forgive, but we don't know who to forgive." And that's really remarkable, to be expressing a desire to forgive without even knowing who it is. And then also the widows of some men who were murdered and tortured by Eugene de Kock, who at that time was known in the South African media as Prime Evil, so one of the sort of hitmen of the extra-legal torture squad of the apartheid regime. And one of the widows of one of the men who killed said, "I forgive him. I want to take him by the hand and show him that he can still change, that there is a better way." And so, you know, these cases are just so sort of breathtaking, I think, because for a number of reasons, but I think lots of us don't feel that we would very easily be forgiving in those circumstances. But I take them to be important and meaningful. So a lot of philosophers defend this idea that forgiveness should only be given in response to the wrongdoer earning it. And those philosophers want to say that these people are doing something morally mistaken. And I find that a very troubling judgment, to look at these people doing these kind of deeply inspiring, sort of breathtaking acts of humanity and say, moral mistake, the wrongdoer hasn't earned it. So I think that philosophers should be responding to, you know, what people actually take themselves to be doing and not be trying to regiment that too much with our views about what it takes to earn forgiveness. And we should be trying to analyze, you know, what do we actually think is going on here that seems so amazing, that impresses us about these kinds of actions.
So one of the common labels that's used to describe that kind of forgiveness is unconditional forgiveness. And obviously there's an intended contrast there with conditional forgiveness. Conditional forgiveness is something that you would give if, for example, you think the perpetrator has felt remorse, apologized, compensated, and maybe undergone a kind of moral reform. This is the kind of thing that Lucy's referring to by saying that perpetrator might have earned forgiveness. And what you're appealing to in some of these TRC cases are, in contrast, unconditional forgiveness. Forgiving someone where you, at the stage of your forgiveness, have no idea whether that perpetrator is repentant, or you think, "Well, I know that he's not repentant, but I'm still ready to forgive him." So some of the philosophers who are worried about that kind of advocacy of unconditional forgiveness might suggest that sometimes it could be dangerous to forgive an unrepentant perpetrator, because in forgiving them, in some sense, you're maybe letting them off the hook. Are you facilitating reoffense if you forgive someone who's completely unrepentant and who would do it again in a heartbeat?
So I think that is an important question, and there are a few kinds of responses I have to that. So one response I have to that is that I think, although not all philosophers do, but I think you can forgive someone in your heart without telling them, because I think that forgiveness is essentially an emotional change. So if you are dealing with somebody who, you know, some kind of abusive situation where the person is dangerous to you, or you don't want to keep being with them, you can do that while forgiving them in your heart. I also think that we shouldn't make it part of the definition of what forgiveness is that it could never be unwise. You know, so it could be, just like loving is generally a good thing, but love can be unwise, love can be dangerous. So we don't want to make it part of the definition of love that it couldn't be imprudent. And similarly, I think with forgiveness, the fact that some forgiving could be imprudent doesn't mean that it's not forgiving. And part of the phenomenon, which in many other cases plays a positive role. So, you know, think about a parent who too quickly forgives their child's transgressions. That might be failing to hold the child accountable in a way that results in something problematic. And that might be imprudent. But I don't think that means that it isn't forgiving.
In your work on forgiveness, you have used a particular label to describe your view. You said forgiveness is elective. What do you mean by that?
Yes, so this is a very big debate in the literature about on forgiveness, about the, some of these questions we've been talking about how much discretion the victim has with respect to whether or not they forgive. So some people think that you should only forgive when the wrongdoer has done something to earn the forgiveness. So it would be wrong to forgive if they haven't. But also, if they have done the stuff to earn the forgiveness, it would be wrong not to forgive. So there are conditions in which it would be a moral mistake to forgive and conditions in which it would be a moral mistake to not forgive. And I want to push back against both sides of that. So I want to say that even in those cases, so like those TRC cases, those women are not making a moral mistake in forgiving, even though there's been no evidence at all of repentance. But also, I want to say that even when the wrongdoer has done quite a lot to apologize and make amends, it doesn't follow that you have to forgive. And that's a place, actually, where Luke, who's written a lot about forgiveness, he takes issue with me on that exact idea in, I think, an important way, which is to say, picture a case where, you know, maybe a not too serious wrong, and the person has, like, really done the work, you know. They've made the amends, they've bought you the flowers, they've said sorry, and it just sort of seems unreasonable for you to keep resenting them. And so Luke's sort of challenge to me is, well, isn't that a bit harsh to think when that person's all done all that work that you shouldn't accept that? So I think there's a lot in that challenge, and I think, and, you know, this comes down a little bit to exactly where you think the core of forgiveness is. So, but what I want to argue is that there is still a core of holding against that the person isn't entitled to insist on. So I think that what is reasonable is that you shouldn't have disproportionate resentment or blame or any of those things. But if we go back to the case where I'm not being disproportionate, I'm not seeing this as characterizing all of you, I'm not railing at you, I'm not being unreasonable about it, it's just that there's that little mark in my little black book. And it's not a too big mark, it's just totally proportionate. And I'm entitled to clock in the record, and you're not entitled to say that you can't be thought of as someone capable of doing this kind of thing. You did this thing. So I am entitled to keep that on the record. And so it sort of comes down to exactly where you think the forgiving is, because I agree with you that there is a lot of resentment you should be ceasing to have at that point. But I think that there is a core of holding against the person that they aren't entitled to assert that you not do, but that we can stop holding it against the person at that point. And that's where I think what's actually really transformative and powerful about forgiveness comes in. And I think there are three features of the kinds of agents that we are that make that important. So the one is that I think we have a deep need to see ourselves as good. I think that's a part of human agency. Another is that I think we're pretty messed up. We're pretty deeply, we're not just like a little bit imperfect. I think we're quite deeply structurally flawed agents in a whole variety of ways, which I think are very interesting, but we could talk a bit more about that if you want to. And then the third is that I think we're not fixed. So there isn't an absolute fact of the matter about what you are. We're messy works in progress who are constantly forming ourselves by our choices. And because we're messy works in progress who are constantly forming ourselves by our choices, this goes back to the question of whether the changed view is irrational, it's possible to interpret someone in an optimistic light that sees them as better than their wrongdoing indicates them to be, because it's possible for them to be that. But they're not entitled to insist that you see them in that way, but it's possible to see them in that way. And I think that that's very important for us, that we need that, especially because we have this need to see ourselves as good. So taking on board your wrongdoing, that you really did something wrong, can be very hard to take on board your wrongdoing while still seeing yourself as good. And that leads us to lurch between two unhelpful responses: leniency and despair. So despair is when you sort of have this, well, this is just who I am. There's nothing I can do about it. I just am this terrible person who did this thing. And leniency is when you too easily let yourself off the hook. And both of those, I think, are unhelpful responses which are not conducive to real moral growth. But when a person forgives you, I think they give you this generous and optional gift of seeing you in this optimistic way that sees you as better than your action indicates you to be. And that can help you to keep hold of an understanding of yourself as oriented to the good, while taking seriously this wrong that you have actually really done. And I think that that can play a really important and transformative role in our relationships. So there's another, a Canadian-American philosopher, Victoria McGeer, who spends half the year actually in Australia. So she's written a lot about what she talks about, the scaffolding role of these moral emotions and the way they help us develop moral characters. And I was talking a little bit earlier about blame potentially playing a scaffolding role. She looks at how forgiveness can play that role by the galvanizing effect of another person's view of you as better than your action indicates you to be can help you be that better way of being. And it's more helpful than being given some moral exemplar of some, you know, perfect person, and you're like, well, how does that help me? But in this case, the vision you're being given is not of some other person, but I need to be like some other person, but I want to be like the way she already sees me as being. And that's easier to get a sort of a motivational grip. And so I think that there is this way in which forgiveness enables us to move forward with each other without seeing each other as defined by our worst acts, so without keeping all those little checks in the little black book, and that can play a really powerful role in relationships, but also that it's something that you don't have to do. There are lots of cases in which you're entitled to just keep the checks. People tell you who they are by their actions.
Okay, thanks, Lucy. That's fantastic. Thanks for sharing your views on forgiveness with us.
Philosophers Lucy Allais and Luke Russell inviting you to consider the moral and the emotional weight of being asked to forgive someone. Natasha Mitchell with ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, our live event show. And this is an event from the 2025 Anderson Lectures in Philosophy at the University of Sydney. So what does the audience in the room think at this stage? Let's hear from them.
Thanks very much, Lucy. I was wondering if, given the emphasis you laid towards the end on the future, that this I see you in an optimistic light, there's this openness that you might, that the perpetrator will then have this opportunity to see themselves as better than who they are. This futural component, wonder if that means that you can't forgive the dead.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you can forgive the dead. And that means that those words I was using are not exactly accurate. They're trying to get at the idea of a way of interpreting someone in the light of better willing than they've demonstrated. That quite often, when we're in sort of common cases, when we're moving forward with someone, optimism sort of is a way of capturing that. But I think there's a way of altering your affective regard of somebody who's dead, for example, where you're interpreting them in the light of better willing. It's still about your view of them. It's still an interpretation of them. And I think, you know, there's a philosopher who writes on forgiveness in Canada, Kate Norlock, who argues that you still have relationships with the dead. So I don't know what I think about that. But I think it's still relational in the sense that it is about the person. And that's actually part of what's usually meaningful about forgiving the dead. I mean, of course, you can reorient your views towards your dead relatives or people who've harmed you by excusing and justifying, so by coming to understand. But that can be a way of coming to see that there was nothing to forgive. But it can also be a way of coming to interpret them in the light of better willing.
Hi. It's possible that you don't have something like forgive myself or something. But if you would have something like whether I forgive myself easily or whether I don't forgive myself easily, that might be important. Because if I very easily forgive myself and the other don't forgive me, or the opposite, I think that would create other troubles. So I am thinking about abuse. So in abuse, one will have like a lot of forgiveness and a very low bump for, oh, I already forgive from that time. And the abuser would be just a very different kind who never really accuse himself. And then I am worried that because yours is always about one side, you don't see whether by your forgiveness you actually encourage the other to be an abuser. So I am worried that because it's not interlocked, then you don't see the possible consequences. And with war criminals, I think to forgive war criminals is somehow very funny. If I am religious, I might do it. But otherwise, I might think that if someone... So it's a bit like going to heaven is too easy. Forgiveness makes extreme sins too easy. And if you don't have the two things... Because I would guess that the war criminal would have that problem, that he wouldn't...
I think there's definitely a legitimate concern. Luke was asking about that earlier, about whether forgiving people too easily lets them off the hook and doesn't hold them accountable. I think that's an important concern. And in abuse situations, it's quite common for abusers to say, like, you know, somebody blows up and then they're like, well, this is all in the past. Can we put the past behind us? Don't keep dwelling on the past. Let's just move forward. And, you know, so I think that's an important concern. Which, as I was saying earlier, two responses I would have to that. One is that you can forgive someone in your heart without telling them, and part of what's causing the concern there is the telling them. And the other is that forgiveness can be imprudent, just like loving can be imprudent. So I think that's a possibility. But you raised at the beginning of your question the issue of self-forgiveness. And so self-forgiveness, I think, is possible, but it's very puzzling and easily problematic. So I think that for self-forgiveness to really make sense, self-forgiveness can't just be leniency. Self-forgiveness has to, for it to really be self-forgiveness, it has to involve having really taken the wrongdoing seriously and finding a way of allowing a view of yourself as a better person than that. I think that that's possible and that can play a real role, but I wouldn't call leniency, where the person has just never taken the wrongdoing seriously, I wouldn't call that self-forgiveness. I think that that's too cheap.
This is a stab at trying to reconcile the idea of self-forgiveness as a moral mistake with the impressiveness of the people who do the forgiving. So there's sometimes a distinction between the moral status of an act and what that act reveals about the person. And sometimes in the case of bad people, there are acts which you might not think are in themselves morally bad, but you know that only a truly wicked person could do it, because the psychological capacity to do that brings with it other genuinely evil things. And I wonder if there is a positive version of that, where there are acts which are themselves moral mistakes, but only someone of immensely high moral character would be capable of making that moral mistake. And maybe forgiveness of this sort is something like that.
That's a great thought. And I think it's definitely possible. And I don't want to sort of regiment too carefully all the cases, but I do really want to allow that there's a way of seeing those people as not making a moral mistake. And I think if you think about the Eugene de Kock widows, she doesn't actually say, I think he's fine. She said, I want to take him by the hand and show him he can still change. And that's actually quite specific. It's not like she's not interpreting him implausibly, but she is interpreting him as a human being in whom there is a possible kernel of something better. But we don't know. I think we don't know that of any human being. So I think she's allowing the possibility that this person, that of even somebody who's done something really terrible, has some possibility in them. So I think there's a way of making sense of that case as not necessarily a moral mistake. Some of them could be, though.
I'm just going to take it to another direction. Recently, I had a friend of mine, his mother was run over and killed. So the immediate thing he did was forgive the driver. The knock-on effect of that was he had this epiphany where that forgiving that particular driver, he changed his whole attitude and he looks at everybody very differently today. And I've never seen such a huge change in somebody by just saying, I forgive her. And this is a really sort of staunch guy who would never change. But this whole situation, him forgiving so quickly, he's really changed his life quite drastically. So he's looking at things completely differently. So that word forgive changed his life quite quickly.
That's a beautiful story. I mean, I'm sorry for his loss, but I think that's a beautiful illustration of something really powerful and transformative in being open to seeing people in more open ways.
When we're discussing anger, you mentioned Fricker's view and you mentioned Aristotle and the appropriateness of it. And then when we're talking about the cases like what he just mentioned or the cases of the widows, and you describe them as breathtaking acts of humanity, which I think that they are, it's like the most inspiring thing that there is. One way of understanding what's going on in those cases is that these people are deviating from the Aristotelian view where anger is appropriate here, so that's what I should do, and they're siding with the Socratic view or the Stoic view or the view of Jesus or the Buddha or these other wisdom traditions that say you can maintain this kind of constant goodwill towards other people. And when I just think about those sorts of cases, why isn't it sort of decisive evidence that we should try to be like that and not go with Aristotle? And so just try to be more like the people who do the breathtaking acts of humanity instead of just being our normal selves who get angry all the time.
So, I do think that most of us could do better to be a bit less angry, and we're very prone to exaggerate other people's offences against us and underplay ours against them and all those things. So I do think that's important. I think that in an ordinary relationship, holding somebody to account with some degree of emotional force is a way of taking them seriously and caring about them. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Doing it disproportionately and or furiously or with hostility and all the other pathologies of anger and blame is a problem. But I don't think that basic move is problematic.
I want to put to you the metaphor, forgive and forget. How does one forget even if one has forgiven? Because forgiveness must also imply, I trust you again.
So it's actually a puzzling metaphor. Philosophers writing about forgiveness often sort of think that maybe there's something wrong in that metaphor, because remember we said that excusing and justifying are ways of seeing that there isn't anything on the record, but forgiving sees the wrong as, in some sense, standing. So how, if you've forgotten, then there isn't anything to forgive, and that seems a little puzzling. So some philosophers actually think that there's just something misleading about that metaphor. I would understand it in terms of, going back to my little black book, that if I've wiped the record in my little black book, then there's sort of a metaphorical sense in which I've forgotten. It's just, it's not there. I'm moving forward with you as if it didn't happen. And in that sense, I think we could make sense metaphorically of having forgotten. Forgiveness is very interestingly related to trust. And I think that if you aren't moving forward with trust, you might not have forgiven.
I would like to thank Luke and Lucy, and let's give a warm round once more.
A rich and searching conversation about that very human dilemma of forgiveness. I know you'll have thoughts. Has forgiveness liberated you, I wonder, or burdened you perhaps? Email me, bigideas@abc.net.au. Lucy Alle is Professor of Philosophy at both the University of Witwatersrand and Johns Hopkins University. Luke Russell is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Sydney. Thanks to them both. Forgiveness, Do We Really Need It? Was part of the 2025 Anderson Lectures in Philosophy. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Next on the show, it's the science of sex. Join me on stage at the World Science Festival, Brisbane. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.